I want to be the title sponsor. What's it going to cost?
I think around 10 million.
Yeah, that's a bit out of my budget.
I have the impression that we are in the place where we have to be now.
Greg had a really bad back all last week, so we caught up on your podcast with me giving him a back massage and him listening to you guys.
That's a wonderful image.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Ned Bolting.
Hello, Richard.
Television's Ned Bolting.
Yeah, you're quoting David Miller there, aren't you? Television's David Miller.
I did an event with him the other night and I introduced him as Television's David Miller. He didn't like it, I don't think.
No one likes it.
It's either that or a retired bike rider. I didn't know which he'd prefer.
Clothier.
Ned's not a retired bike rider, though.
No, that's...
Ned is very much in his prime as a bike rider. So, listen, we've got tons to talk about today, mainly the World Championships in Richmond, Virginia, which finished on Sunday. And we're going to talk a little bit about the news overnight, I suppose, that London has withdrawn from its bid to host the Grand Départ of the Tour de France in 2017. Mm. I know Ned's got lots to say about that. But Lionel, first of all, your weekly news roundup, please.
Yeah, let's rattle through this. World Championship week, of course, lots of rainbow jerseys up for grabs. Big surprise, really, in the men's time trial. Vasyl Kiryienko of Belarus won gold ahead of Adriano Malori and Jerome Coppel of France. That was the 1-2-3. Much to many people's surprise, because the pre-race favourites Rowan Dennis and Tony Martin were only 6th and 7th. In the women's time trial, Linda Willemsen, Danish-born but New Zealand representative, won the women's gold medal. The road races were, well, I thought they were cracking. We'll talk about them in greater depth later on in the episode, but the headlines are that Lizzie Armitstead won the women's road race and Peter Sagan won the men's road race. As simple as that. Off the bike, Mark Cavendish's move to MTN Quebec has been confirmed, although we believe the team will be called Dimension Data or Dimension Data Deloitte next year. They're signing up sponsors as quickly as they're signing up riders. They've also recruited Mark Renshaw and Bernie Eisel and are can't call him erstwhile member of the podcast, Daniel Freeb, because he still is a bona fide member of the podcast.
Has he joined MTN Quebec?
No, he hasn't, but he's been tweeting all day about how this is like, take that, getting back together again. It's a sort of HTC High Road reunion, isn't it, at MTN Quebec next year. Meanwhile, Team Sky confirmed 7 new signings, including the outgoing world champion Michał Kwiatkowski and the revelation from the Giro d'Italia, Mikel Landa. And as Richard mentioned, London will not be hosting the 2017 Grand Départ, much to everybody's, well, surprise that they were even in the running at one point, and then surprise that they would be given the honour and then decide not to go any further with it.
Much to everyone's chagrin, not least friend of the podcast, Prudy, Christian Prudhomme. I don't imagine he'll be very happy. Just before we start, and I think we'll probably start with Lizzie Armitstead's win in the women's road race, but you mentioned a high road reunion there at MTN Quebec. A good opportunity to plug a forthcoming Friends special podcast, which Daniel's been working on all year. And it's really looking back at High Road and exactly what happened. We've got an exclusive interview with Bob Stapleton.
Ooh.
Yep, breaking his silence. Rolf Aldag, Brian Holm, other people who were involved in that very successful team, HCC Columbia High Road, which disbanded at the end of 2011. And a lot of them coming back together at MTN Quebec. So that's coming up very soon as a Friends special. A look back on what actually happened with the end of the High Road. But let's talk about events in Richmond, Virginia. Men's and women's road races both, I thought, won by the right rider, which is quite unusual. It's quite unusual that the World Championship road race is won by a rider who, you can honestly say, that is the best rider in the world at the moment. And Lizzie Armitstead has been really raised her game, I think, this year. Won the World Cup, very consistent, and it looked as if the race was slipping away from her towards the end when the group got away, but came back and Was she lucky there, or was it inevitable that group was going to come back? Did you think, Ned? I know you watched it quite closely.
Well, she's had an... I think you have to take that race in the context of her season, which, as you rightly say, has been outstanding. I mean, by far, I know she got the silver medal in 2012, but she's a much, much stronger and more mature and more rounded and complete rider now, albeit in the absence of Marianne Vos, it has to be said, this year. But the continuing absence through injury. But Lizzie Armitstead has grown round by round of the World Cup and week by week and month by month this year, and absolutely deserved that. And I think it was what she's begun to learn about herself is that, and this hasn't always featured over the last couple of years, is that she can back herself now to win, if not a bunch sprint, although she's quite capable of winning a bunch sprint in the women's scene, certainly a group sprint, you know, against some of the best in the world. And in previous years, she's fought shy of getting herself into that situation and assumed that the only way she can win a race of the kind of stature of the world is to get away on her own. You know, always seeking out the tough courses, complaining or riding within herself and being uncomfortable when it looks like the course is slightly too easy, in inverted commas, worrying about that, not believing in herself. But what she's added this year is that extra 5-10% of self-belief. And it was you really saw that in the way it played out, because, you know, in the final, I always get the number of meters wrong. I can't remember what it was. Final 300 meters or 200 or something. She just maybe 500. I don't know. She decided to go, and you kind of thought, ooh, this isn't going to work, because she didn't actually get away. And then she had the good sense, didn't she, to kind of rein it in, sit up, recover for however many seconds she was allowed to recover before she had to go again. And only a very, very strong and confident rider can pull off a trick like that.
Yeah, it was 900 metres to go, actually, when the group was probably too big. There was the chance of a sort of surprise sprint finish. And she very sort of methodically, really, reduced that group. She made everybody chase back and spend that effort closing up the wheel. And she dragged a group of maybe eight away with her, and the gap opened. And then when everybody got back on, she'd done her recovery, and everybody else was still sort of playing catch-up a little bit. But it was the sprint finish, wasn't it, Ned, that really illustrated exactly what you're saying? Because the Belarusian rider went on the right-hand side of Armitstead, and she just watched her go, didn't react too early. That would have been the obvious mistake, or the easy mistake to make. And she was in the perfect position on, it was Anna van der Breggen's wheel, a great wheel to be on, and she just picked her moment perfectly. And... But, yeah, there were numerous opportunities for that race to go wrong for her, because I was really surprised. I listened to Daniel's description of the course in last week's podcast. I actually thought it was a belting course. The cobbles obviously gave it a bit of a quirky nature, but it was just perfectly pitched. We often talk about the World Championship course, and we said it in last week's podcast about how we assume it's going to be a bunch sprint, because there isn't that many metres of climbing. But you don't need a long, hard climb to make a really good race. What made that race was all the corners that forced everybody to think about positioning, think about where to spend effort, and if they got anything wrong, they were spending more effort over the course of the race. And obviously the corners into the climbs really made it a very, very exciting course to watch a race on. And I thought, you know, that's to see a World Championships that isn't just like one big climb like Ponferrada was last year, really varied it. And like you say, Rich, that's what meant we got the two best winners.
Worth mentioning the men's under 23 road race as well, which I watched on Friday evening, and that was the first indication for me that this was going to produce exciting racing. You could see the course was technical, that you had to be at the front and that only the strongest guys could be at the front. It was very strung out. There was carnage, you know, if you weren't in the top 30 or so. Kevin Ledanois won that race for France. French riders first and third, Italian riders second and fourth. Perhaps the most notable incident in that race was Davide Martinelli, son of Giuseppe Martinelli, the Astana DS, who got a break with Ireland's Eddie Dunbar. And Eddie Dunbar was very enthusiastic, a little bit too eager, I think, in hindsight, but that group that formed, Martinelli was a passenger in it, didn't do a tap, which, that's fine, that's up to him. I didn't really understand why the others were putting so much into it with an Italian passenger sitting there. And I say it's fine. It is fine to sit on a group, but I don't think it's fine to then attack them as he did. There was then a wonderful moment of karma when his bike collapsed underneath him. He had mechanical problems. He was off his bike. That was quite an enjoyable moment. But you don't attack after sitting on a group.
Well, if you can. I mean, it's nothing to say you can't, but you ain't going to make friends in the long term.
You strike me as the type that might do that, Ned.
Yeah, I absolutely would. I'm that desperate for any kind of success. I totally would. I think people can get extravagantly pious about this kind of thing, and I think that that's bike racing to a certain extent. What I did like was I like Dunbar's crazy. I mean, every race he, you know, every time he enters a race, that's what he does. He just gets up the road, and I quite like the way that clearly they are. Whether he's riding for the national team, he was a one-man team. He had no teammates in this instance, or whether he's riding for his team NFTO, they all indulge him. He's only 19. I think he's just 19. So you know, why give him this? Why do anything else with this very, very young rider at the moment, other than just say, go and express yourself? It's really interesting, actually, talking to his team as I was at the weekend. They are resigned to losing him. He's off. He's had generated a lot of interest from World Tour teams, but as I understand it, it's not a World Tour team that's picked him up. I don't know which one it is, but he's moving up a level. He'll be riding Pro Conti. Do you know? I mean, I don't know where he's heading.
Not One Pro Cycling, is it? I suppose another British team that's moving up to Pro Conti.
Yeah, it could be. That'd be slightly disappointing if it was, I suppose. But he's, you know, I know that for a fact that
MTN Quebeca.
You never know. You never know with their recruitment policy, because they've changed. They've changed. MTN, you've changed.
Well, that's something we'll be returning to later on. But yeah, just finally on the women's road race, Lizzie Armitstead, an outstanding winner. She certainly, she rode it, as you say, to win. I felt, you know, going back to London in 2012 when she skated Marianne Vos, she resigned herself to second there quite early on in the race, I felt. I think her mindset, mentality has changed completely. She didn't like a question that she was asked in the press conference about the absence of Marianne Vos particularly. But she'll go to Rio next year as one of the favourites on what's likely to be a much hillier course, and perhaps one not quite as suited to her talents. But if she continues to progress as she has done, then no reason why she can't win there as well.
No, there is no reason, but it's worth, you know, and this in all of our eulogies, quite rightly for what she produced in Richmond, it's worth, I think, just as the women's season comes to a close, referencing quite how strong the field is. And, you know, with a year between now and Rio, whilst Lizzie may well be favourite, she'll face stern competition. You know, Elisa Longo-Borghini is the heir apparent. Anna van der Breggen is, you know, in terms of her physical capability, every bit as good as Lizzie, but she's technically a basket case at the moment. I mean, she made an absolute dog's dinner of the World Cup. And the final round, she should have won it, and all she had to do was sit on Lizzie's wheel and decided to attack, and it played into Lizzie Armitstead's hand. And again, I thought she was, Lionel, you referenced it, I didn't think she rode particularly smart in Richmond. But there are a number of riders who are coming through to you know, fill the vacuum that is being left by the puzzling absence of Marianne Vos and the big question mark as to whether or not she'll ever come back in any kind of championship form.
Well, Pauline Ferrand-Prevot as well, who of course won the world title last year, very young and very versatile, and probably will fancy that course next year.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Trainer Road, cycling's most effective training tool. Pair your power meter with over 800 workouts and 80 training plans to make you a faster cyclist. Visit trainerroad.com/SPC to try Trainer Road risk-free for 30 days.
So you heard a jingle for Trainer Road, our new sponsor, taking us through the winter, Lionel. We were both out on our bikes this morning, I think, in preparatory training for the programmes that we're going to be signing up to with Trainer Road over the next few weeks and months.
Well, when I got the text message to say that our esteemed guest on the podcast, Ned Bolting, needed to rearrange and meet half an hour earlier, that has basically denied me half an hour's training. So I thought it was some kind of cunning ruse by you, Richard, to be honest, to limit my time on the bike.
Yeah, so we'll be giving more information about our Trainer Road. Well, we'll be receiving more information about our Trainer Road training programs soon, Lionel. I know that we're both extremely excited about that. And what we want to do with that is be able to attack like Peter Sagan in the men's road race on Sunday. I'm sure a lot of people did enjoy, I think, Peter Sagan winning. Well, Peter Sagan winning for a start. He won a race. And he seemed to change his approach. You know, gone was the old sort of showing his cards, showing his hand too early. He left it to the decisive moment, and when he went, he went. And there was a fantastic picture of the moment that he attacked, and you've got Greg Van Avermaet, Edvald Boasenhagen behind, and then the others trailing behind, and the expressions on the face tell the story, really. Sagan looked determined, focused. The others were just gasping and suffering, and that was the moment that he won the race. Although the descent that followed, where he built his gap a little bit, was also critical. It really tested all of Sagan's many, many talents. And yeah, again, like the women's road race, I think a feeling that somebody who deserved to be world champion, to wear the rainbow jersey for the year, had won the race.
Yeah, it's that when Peter Sagan won that, sometimes with the worlds, it's a bit, you find out, you know, maybe you haven't been able to watch the race live, or you just find out who's won, you go, oh, blimey, he won. And it's quite often like that. You think, oh, good on him. I wonder how that happened. You find out that Peter Sagan won at Richmond, and you go, yeah, that makes absolute sense. That's just, you know, in hindsight, that was clearly perfectly designed, that course, for him, and he read it to perfection. He was, as far as I understand it, I didn't see the whole race. How could anyone see the whole race unless you were paid to commentate on it? It's 140 hours long. He was pretty invisible, wasn't he? I mean, and up until, as you say, he decided to make his move. And, yeah, just great. What can you say?
Particularly as he was more or less on his own.
Uri Sagan.
Yeah, I mean, and he might have had a little bit of help, I think, from a couple of Tinkoff Saxo people unofficially, sort of under the table assistance. But as you said, Richard, it was that descent that was just so thrilling to watch. And I think you said that if you want to attract young people to the excitement of bike racing, show them Peter Sagan, because although it's perhaps not to be copied, the way he sat down on the top tube, got himself very low, you know, wasn't pedalling down that descent at all, but was clearly opening the gap on the people behind him, you know, that looked exciting.
He's about the only bike rider in the world who can carry that off, who can actually not look like a complete idiot doing that.
Yeah, and he looks like he's just messing about. The way he took the corners was fantastic. On Monday, some footage emerged of him pulling his foot out in the final uphill rise to the finish and sort of calmly putting his foot back into his pedal and carrying on. I mean, there was a moment in the last 300 metres perhaps where it looked like he was dying and the gap was closing, and the sprint behind by that stage was fully committed to try and pip him on the line, but he just had a little half glance over the shoulder and then a sort of nonchalant victory celebration, which said, you know, was anyone really surprised by this victory rather than hooray, I'm the world champion.
Climbed off his bike and then strode like a boxer, like a prize fighter, back down the finish straight. And what was telling, I thought, was that the reaction of some of his peers, rivals, Tom Bonin and people like that, who seemed genuinely happy that he'd won. Even Michael Matthews, who was very disappointed to finish second after perhaps the wrong approach from the Australian team, who had two men up there, Simon Gerrans, but as Matthew said afterwards, they were both riding for themselves. That perhaps wasn't the best move. But even he said that he was pleased that someone like Peter Sagan won it. I mean, he just seems to have fun. He seems to be enjoying himself. And this goes right back to when he first emerged, appeared on the circuit in 2010. I was at the Tour Down Under when he rode that race for Liquid Gas. He was I think he was 19 at the time. He was very young. He got in a break in the opening criterium with Lance Armstrong, who was the oldest man in the race. And he that whole week at the Tour Down Under, he just seemed to have fun. I've told this story many times, but I arranged to interview him one evening, and he crashed that day quite badly at 3 kilometres to go or something. So I didn't think he would turn up for the interview, but I went to the hotel lobby as arranged and bumped into his DS, who he'd sent to collect me and take me up to his room, where he was lying covered in bandages and in a right state. And while we were talking, I say talking, his English at the time was really not very good, and it has improved enormously in that time. But while we were trying to talk, the race was played on TV, and when it came to the moment of his crash, he sort of leapt forward and studied it and wanted to watch the crash and to understand what happened, and he seemed to quite enjoy watching it. It was quite odd, but I remember thinking at the time, this guy is special. And I mean, he is special, and you've got a particularly close relationship with him, haven't you, Ned?
Well, just by dint of having to, you know, the poor guy, it's four green jerseys in consecutive years on the tour, isn't it? So every single day he has media obligations, and every single day we talk to him. And every single day it strikes me he finishes in second place. You know, he's broken that duck on Grand Tours and the Vuelta now. But and you do run out of ways. And he's so right. And one of the reasons he's popular, and I don't think he's different between... I think he doesn't put on a different act when he talks to the media as when he talks to his peers in the peloton. And this is what's great about him, I think. Because so this kind of... he's like an open book. His frustration and his puzzlement, and you know, his it's impossible for me to win. How can I win? I don't know what to do. I've run out of this wonderful invention of the word unluck. You know, he's just built. He's built. You know, innocently, he's built an entire mythology about him, and he's so exceptional. And Lionel, I mean, I was at an event at the weekend with Sean Kelly, who is full of admiration for Peter Sagan, and I think recognises a kindred spirit to some extent. And it's just so good to see a rider, a throwback rider like Peter Sagan, of a Kelly-esque kind of stature, finding a niche in this landscape that does him no favours.
Well, he's Kelly-esque in his consistency. Kelly was somebody who'd be competitive from February through to October, and Sagan's consistency is incredible. And I think a lot of us feared for what would happen to him joining Tinkoff Saxo on this €4 million salary this year, having Tinkoff on his back. There have been times, I think, when that has got to him a bit. The Tour of California was one, but it brought out the best in him. He won that race with a phenomenal performance. But if you go look back to E3 Harelbeke, the race that Geraint Thomas won way back in March, when they were away together, and Geraint Thomas attacked and dropped Sagan, you thought, whoa, that's, you know, that shouldn't really happen. It should be the other way around. And there were rumours about his lifestyle and, you know, whether the €4 million salary was doing him any favours, that his head had fallen off a little bit, and that he didn't seem to have it towards the end of these really long races. He seemed to be good up to 200 kilometres and not good beyond this. So to go and perform like that in such a long race is a great testament to how hard he's worked, I think, as well this year.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's if you include the Slovakian time trial and road race championships, I think that makes it 10 wins he's had this year, 15 second places, around about 7 or 8 third places. He's on the podium in a quarter of the days of racing that he rides. You know, that is incredible. I mean, and I think we said this before, the only stages he couldn't win would be the high, high mountain stages. But if he were to get into a break, he could even win those. And I mean, obviously the big curse in cycling is what can he do next, and there's a whole load of classics that he should win. A rider of his ability should win, and as his maturity and sort of mental focus perhaps changes, and maybe the winning of the world championships will be the making of him as a sort of dominant one day rider. But you know, the Tour of California brought out the best of him in terms of climbing. Really, Richard, you said it, pound for pound, if and you called him a prize fighter, he is the best bike rider in the world on the men's side of the sport, without any doubt.
It perhaps also did him no favours in a funny roundabout kind of way that a motorbike tried to kill him on the Vuelta, ending his Grand Tour participation a couple of weeks early, because he came to the Worlds recovered and fresher than a lot of the other riders, or who were either undercooked or slightly overcooked. But Sagan, you know, that might have worked in his favour ultimately.
I felt a little bit for Edvald Boasenhagen, who's clearly in great form, and you know, he often with him, you can see that he knows the moment. His instinct is good. The legs just aren't there. We saw it a couple of years ago, the World Championship that Philippe Gilbert won. He was similarly well positioned, but just didn't quite have it at that crucial moment. And you know, at one point, 7-8 years ago now, we were talking about Boasenhagen as a Sagan-like rider. The first time I've ever been watching bike racing, and a David Cameron quote has popped into my head. Remember David Cameron said to Tony Blair, "You were the future once." I thought of that as Bosun Hagen sort of desperately tried to get Sagan's wheel.
Yeah, just on Sagan. Sorry, my train of thought has completely gone there.
I thought it was a David Cameron mention.
The Jeremy Corbyn anecdote that springs to mind.
Who's the Jeremy Corbyn of professional cycling?
Oh, goodness me.
For those not listening in the UK, he's the leader of the Labour Party. For those listening in the UK, he's the leader of the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn of professional cycling.
This is not great podcasting etiquette. Long silences. I was going to say, don't tend to sort of overblow sort of Twitter reaction to things, but I saw Oleg Tinkoff's reaction to Sagan's win was very strange.
What was it? I missed that.
Well, he basically said that he was in Russia and he hadn't been able to watch it, which, for one of the world's, well, one of cycling's richest men, it does seem strange that he wasn't able to find at least an online feed to watch the race.
It's the only race where his team isn't competing, I suppose. And one of the great things about Peter Sagan winning the world title is that we'll not have to see his hideous Slovakian champions jersey for another 12 months, and then I guess we will see it again quite a lot.
Yeah, but we might not see much of the rainbow jersey on the tour as well, because it might be all greened up pretty quickly.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Anyway, while we paused there, Lionel, something came to you. The Jeremy Corbyn of cycling is...
It's the UCI president, Brian Cookson, of course. It's got to be. The physical resemblance is there. They've both got the kind of the beard. They're both, I'd say, I'm not sure how old Brian is, but he's in his early 60s, I think, isn't he? Jeremy Corbyn, 66.
Prefer the open neck look over the tie, I think.
Yeah, and they're bringing something different to the world of politics and sports politics, I suppose.
Hey, well, talking of sports politics, we were going to talk about the Tour de France, the Grand Départ in London that none of us knew was going to be happening, and it turns out it isn't. Before we talk about that, let's hear exclusively a couple little clips from Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, who was a predecessor to Boris Johnson, the current mayor, who has made the decision that the Grand Départ will not come to London in 2017. Ned, you met Ken Livingstone for your book On the Road Bike, which was about sort of British culture, cycling culture, I guess, and Ken Livingstone was one of the people you met, and you spoke to him about the Grand Départ in 2007, which was hugely successful, and about the prospects of another one coming. Can you just introduce these little clips that we're about to hear?
Yeah, the first one just gives you a sense of how cheap the Grand Départ in 2007 was, and how much of a no-brainer it was really for London, you know, to get hold of and capitalise on. And the second clip, and you really have to take this in the context of an election campaign that Ken was fighting and losing against Boris Johnson in 2011, is his take on the Johnson regime and their attitude towards bringing the race back to London.
Did you know anything about the option to bring a stage of the Tour de France back to London?
Yeah, well, virtually that was a done deal, because they were so over the moon. And in my talks with them, which was very informal, but that's the way you deal with them, you know, a lot of lawyers around, I said we'd like to have a stage before the Olympics. And as far as I said,
within the lifetime of this administration? Yeah, yeah.
There's supposed to be a stage before the Olympics, but apparently that hasn't been pursued, so it's not happening. But certainly one of the first things I'll do is, you know, be off to see them and say, you know, when can we do another Grand Départ, or at least get a stage. So coming to London was, you know, amazing for, you know, world cycling and the Tour. So they'll jump at it, you know. And I mean, I think it's always, I mean, the earliest you'd get one is in the final year of a term if you started bidding for it.
Have you got, if it just makes such financial good sense, and it's a relatively easy gig to organise, have you got any idea why that might have gone away under this current administration?
Because, I mean, Boris doesn't initiate anything or do anything. Boris is basically lazy. The tour officials went out to a restaurant, we drank too much, we had a good laugh, you know. It was such an easy, you know, pleasure to work with them.
You took them to, I think I'm right saying, to Le Pont de la Tour, didn't you?
Yeah.
Do you remember that dinner?
I don't remember. It blurs.
Yeah, I'm sure it does.
I think they carried me out at the end of it. I mean, but they enjoy themselves, and they were a real pleasure to work with. They really were.
Did the name, I think Bernardino, it's a name that probably means nothing to you even now, but he's a 5-times winner of the Tour de France.
Oh, right, right.
He's one of their ambassadors. In those days, probably
there was the old guy who was just giving up and handing over to Proudhon. Who was that?
LeBlanc.
Yeah. He was giving up. He was great.
Was he? Was he the man who you had to deal with when it came to?
Well, we met. The two of them were all there. Well, there was no problem. It doesn't cost anything.
But it cost £7 million, didn't it?
Yeah, but we only had to put in. I mean, we had to pay them £1.5 million. The honour of doing the Grand Depart. Then there was putting on the event. We do stuff like that all the time, you know. I can't remember what. It's in the autobiography that I think the figures we made 90 million or 110 or something like that.
There's a tenfold.
Compared the rate of return on putting on the Tour de France compared with putting on the Olympics. It's just so cheap.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
So there we heard Ken Livingstone, the previous London mayor. And we've learned today that Boris Johnson, the current mayor, did kibosh it. It was about the contracts were about to be exchanged. It was going to be announced very soon that the 27 Grand Depart was going to come to 2017 Grand Depart was going to come to London 10 years after its last visit. It's not going to happen now, and I don't imagine Tour de France bosses are too pleased about that. Ned, I think you've been appearing all over the media today talking about this. What's your take on it?
I think that it is the right decision reached in a terribly incompetent way, because, you know, why do you bid for something? So if you bid for something assuming that there's a certain kind of asking price that you're going to have to find, and if the Grand Depart in Yorkshire was 27 million, then with 3 years inflation added to that, the figure of 35 million doesn't strike me as too surprising. That said, it's worth stressing that not all of that 35 million, far from it, goes to ASO. If you listen to that clip from Ken Livingstone, he explained that they paid in 2007 1.5 million directly to ASO, and the rest of the 7 million, so the other 5.5 million, was made up of logistical, you know, getting the thing on sort of thing. So whilst I would imagine ASO have considerably upped their expectations of what is paid directly to them, not all of that 35 million is going into their coffers. So, you know, why bid for something only to withdraw when you find out that precisely the kind of money you were expecting to pay? Then, you know, it just strikes me as, you know, they've either not appreciated how much they might have to pay, or they've changed policy midstream, and I think it's the latter. I think they've got cold feet midstream, and I don't think they're wrong. I think that it was ill-conceived to bid for it in the first place, because now that's not to say I don't think we are ready, even as early as 2017, for another UK Grand Depart. I just don't think it should be London. I think that London now hosts year on year the final stage of the Tour of Britain. Fantastic circuit this year, right in the middle of, you know, Regent Street and everything. And Ride London Surrey Classic has also shuts down central London for a big bike race. That's twice a year. 2014, London hosted a stage of the Tour de France. 2007 isn't that long ago. And frankly, Londoners' eyes have been opened to cycling and competitive cycling in all its forms. I don't think you'd really shift the landscape further that much more than has already been done. And frankly, as a London commuting cyclist, I'd prefer to see them spend that money on segregated cycling lanes, etc., etc., and leave the playing field open to Edinburgh, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think 2007, why did the Tour come to London? It came because it was part of a Transport for London strategy to persuade more people to use bikes. It was around about the time of the launch of the what had become now known as the Boris bike, even though it was Ken Livingstone who put them into place, to promote cycling as part of the infrastructure. And as we know, we don't want to get sort of too political on the cycling podcast, but people are still getting killed on the roads just commuting to work on their bikes, and that is the problem that needs to be solved. Yes, it would be fantastic to have another Grand Depart in the UK, but I think, Ned, you're absolutely right. It should go to another region. And I also think that, you know, ASO, in their eagerness to increase the financial worth of their events, London really helped them do that. Yeah. It really expanded their horizons a great deal, and we've all been to the Grand Departs subsequent to that. You know, some of them have been really low key. I mean, the Vendée was very low key the following year, 2008, or was that Brittany? And the Brittany 2008, the Vendée a few years later was also low key. Even Monaco, you know, an iconic venue in 2009, but a real sort of flat feeling that the Tour de France
Corsica in 2013 virtually deserted.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the foreign Grand Depart has become a key part of ASO's kind of business strategy. The price has gone up accordingly, and I think, you know, the ASO may well have to rein in their expectations a little bit.
Well, London is a prestige place to have it, and you wonder if that's a big part of the attraction for ASO. But it is very unusual to hold a Grand Depart in the same place. So, you know, 10 years apart, when there are all these other places to go to.
Liège 2004, 2012, yeah.
And of course Utrecht this year. It used to be 1 year on, 1 year off, but it seems to be more fluid and flexible now. And there's talk of a Germany Grand Depart, which I think it would be fantastic. Yeah. You know, that would be potential, that could do for Germany what the Grand Depart did for British cycling back in 2007, because I think it did kickstart a lot. I think, you know, it helped. It kind of galvanised Dave Brailsford and his ideas to set up a pro team. So the genesis of Team Sky is almost in that Grand Depart in 2007. It showed that huge appetite for it, while also, you know, allowing the likes of Geraint Thomas and Mark Cavendish to make their debut and prove that the riders were coming along as well.
It's interesting, when this was first mooted about London getting heavily involved in July during the Tour de France, I had a kind of off the record conversation, I'm quite happy to put on the record now, with Dave Brailsford, as you do. We were just talking about it, and I voiced precisely my own concerns that I've just voiced about, you know, killing the goose that lays the golden egg, over exposing the Tour de France to the British public, spoiling us really, and it takes away this sort of special feeling that it only visits maybe once in a generation. And he went, interesting. Be good for us though. And I think that he, in his, you know, he has to keep Sky as sponsors happy and constantly setting them new targets and things that they can focus on. And I think a British Grand Depart, especially in London, would have been really important for Sky in terms of, you know, the valuation they put on the team and that sponsorship. But, you know, everybody involved in cycling sees it in slightly different ways. And we as journalists probably feel, well, I quite fancy going to Germany, actually, you know, rather than necessarily London in 2017, because it's interesting and it's new territory, or, you know, revisiting old territory. And but so I can entirely understand British cycling fans who may be listening to this podcast who are very disappointed as well. You know, we each take our own little bit out of the tour, but I mean, I think it's a correct decision reached in a very, very kind of cobbled together kind of fashion.
But there will be a Grand Depart in the UK at some point in the next 4 to 5 years. Several other places are in the running for it. I think Edinburgh's bid is revived. There's a couple of others that I've heard rumbles about dotted around the country. So it will come back, and I think it will be beneficial if it's not in London.
What about the Worlds?
Well, there's talk of Yorkshire. Our friend Sir Gary Verity has been speaking about that. It's very, very, very expensive. Apparently it costs more to host the Worlds than it does to have a Grand Depart. They shut the road down for a week. Yeah, it's longer. The UCI make a lot of, UCI charge a lot of money. The UCI make a lot of demands for prime hotel rooms, an awful lot more than ASO, I'm led to believe. So the financial outlay is much greater. And I think there's a concern that the profile among, not among cycling fans, but among the general population, isn't the same as for... So I don't know, financially it's a harder sell.
I mean, really, honestly, for anything other than the hardcore cycling fans, three quarters of the programme of events is not attractive. Even in Richmond, the crowds were pretty small for everything except the men's road race on the Sunday and, to a degree, the women's road race on the Saturday.
Listen, let's talk. I think you have to dash off soon, Ned.
We're going to talk about that again to ITV News this time.
Don't give them your best stuff, you know. Hopefully you've used that on us. We must mention, and we'll talk just briefly, I think, on some of the other signings. Cavendish to MTN Quebec and Team Sky have unveiled build an incredibly strong lineup. Just a quick mention for an event that we're doing on Sunday the 15th of November at Lord's Cricket Ground, the home of cycling, 2 to 3 p.m.
It's the home of cricket.
Yeah, that was a deliberate mistake, Ned.
Oh, see, was that heavy use?
We're taking over the home of cycling. It's we're going to take it over for the day. We're doing a cycling podcast live event, 2 to 3 p.m. Sunday the 15th of November. It will be recorded and released as a podcast as well. So come along. We need an audience. Come along. It's tickets are available on the London Sports Writing Festival website.
Yeah, we're going to come up with some kind of idea, aren't we? For similar to the imperfect Tour de France.
It'll be structured, Lionel.
It will be structured. There will be an idea at its core. It won't just be us rambling on like normal.
No. It'll be carefully planned and thought out. Yeah. Don't you worry.
You're just going to plug the imperfect Tour de France event that we did at Foyles before the tour to give you a flavour of what we can do live in front of an audience.
This is desperate.
Sign up to become a friend of the podcast. It's only £5. There's a whole host of specials. We've got 3 or 4 more to come before the end of the year. Thecyclingpodcast.com for details.
One of those will be me in conversation with David Miller, which is happening this Thursday in Manchester. I think tickets are still available for that. We're going to be releasing that as a special podcast as well, talking about his new book, The Racer, which is very good. I recommend it thoroughly. Let's just talk quickly on transfers. Mark Cavendish to MTN Quebeca. First mentioned, I think, on the cycling podcast back in May. Daniel Freeb, to give him his credit, mentioned it, mooted it on the cycling podcast back in May after the tour of Turkey when he spoke to Brian Smith, and Brian Smith had his first conversation with Cavendish at the tour of Turkey about possibly joining the team. It's come to pass. Dimension Data and Deloitte are the new sponsors on board. Is it going to work? This sort of reunion, the boy band back together, Izel, Renshaw, Cavendish, we think maybe Brian Holm as well. Is it going to work, Ned, or is it going to end in tears?
Well, comebacks, generally speaking, or rather, you know, what is this, a comeback tour?
I don't call it a comeback.
Regrouping, general regroupments of riders, you know, after several years, after great success.
You mentioned there of Sean Kelly, the commentator on the Home of Cycling, British Eurosport.
Yeah, exactly. Don't tend to work, do they? Doesn't tend to work in sport. Revisiting past glories with your compadres who brought you that success. However, he does need... what is self-evident is he does need a team absolutely built around him. And I'm not sure that's... Although he had a tremendously strong, in theory, kind of lead out at Eddie's Quickstep, it hasn't always worked out that way and hasn't been... For whatever reason, it's quite hard to put your finger on why it didn't really work at Etix Quickstep, given the big engines that he had at his disposal there. I don't know. I hope it does, but who knows? What it does make me slightly curious or slightly uneasy is that was a team that kind of grabbed people's attention for very different reasons, actually. And it seems, in a way, a shame that they will have to abandon some of their principles that they brought to the fore in order to accommodate Mark Cavendish and his Grand Tour or his Tour de France ambitions.
Well, I suppose there are two ways of looking at that, aren't there? I mean, Mark Cavendish is a global star who will bring more attention to the team and probably will become a significant figure in Africa, perhaps. I don't know. The other thing is that the other sort of concern, I guess, though, is some of the other riders on the team. Someone like Steve Cummings, who we've spoken about, who... is very much a free spirit. There'll be a lot of riders on that team. I imagine Edvald Boasenhagen, Tyler Farrar, who, Ned, I have to take issue with, because we did an event in Liverpool last week and you were laughing at the idea of Tyler Farrar preparing for the World Championships.
I know, and he showed himself, didn't he? He and his ponytail were fully on display.
What's Tyler Farrar preparing for the World Championships for? What's he going to do? There he was on the attack. He got himself on TV. Anyway, Tyler Farrar and Cavendish have a very prickly relationship. The idea of Farrar being part of his lead-out train seems pretty far-fetched to me. And some of the other riders on that team who bought into the whole... Cholek, Goss. Farrar. Will Goss still be there? Theo Boss.
Poor old Boasenhagen. You know, he's going to get elbowed to the fringes again, isn't he? Just as he's kind of, you know, like a little...
Find his mojo again.
Yeah, just sort of like a little mole. He's popped up out of his hole and he's won the Tour of Britain in very sort of, you know, impressive style. And then sort of Mark Cavendish swaggers back in like a sort of badger baring his teeth. Black and white stripes badger. I think it's a strange one, but I think we talked about this a while back about how a team, as it grows, it has to it has to move to the next level. Otherwise, you know, it's attracting these sponsors. It has to deliver value for those sponsors. Developing riders from Africa, if that remains part of their core reason for being, then I think that would be fantastic. The question is whether there's room for all of that, as well as trying to keep Mark Cavendish in the wins that he's accustomed to aiming for.
Well, he's super happy, Mark Cavendish. I saw the press release today, and I think he's only happy, which is maybe cause for alarm. He's not super happy, he's only happy. Should we be worried? Should they be worried?
Very. But maybe they're just doing the right thing now and assembling that kind of ridiculous roster of slightly superannuated sprinters who aren't going to win you that many races was the wrong thing to do. And actually, maybe you're right, and they have got their marquee sprinter now who will win races, and that's probably what they should have done all along. But you'd have thought there'll be a lot of Farrells and Gosses and Bösenhagens and who's the other one, Ciolek and Boss of the world, unless they're going to have a 9-man kind of lead out full of Milan San Remo winners.
There are a few guys there I could see fitting into. There's a lot of Milan San Remo winners in that team. Is it a record? But a guy like Teo Boss, I could see him fitting into a lead out train, but I'm not sure about Goss. I don't know
if
EBH, yeah, Edvald Bösenhagen, Tyler, the question is Tyler Farrar, because as I say, I did an interview with Mark Cavendish one January in a training camp. I can't remember where it was. I think it was Mallorca, and we were doing a thing for a magazine where it was previewing the season ahead and, you know, profiling all the top sprinters and getting him to discuss each of his rivals and what their strengths and weaknesses were. And I was going through the list, came to Tyler Farrar, and Cavendish was not happy. He didn't regard him as one of his rivals. No, you know, bleep, including him in a list of my rivals. He's not a rival, you know, and he's just...
Was Russell Downing on the list? There was neither there.
Russell Downing wasn't on the list, although he probably should have been. But no, it was quite interesting. So I don't know if those two have buried the hatchet or how they will be accommodated together in that team.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. And I mean, I think even Brian Smith and Mark Cavendish, I mean, that's going to be an interesting dynamic, isn't it? Two quite, I would have thought, quite different characters.
They've always got on, though, I think, yeah, Cavendish and Brian.
Yeah, but Brian, I mean, Brian's a funny one. I mean, I saw a couple of his tweets this week about Cav leading out Tekla Heimnot for King of the Mountains points. Obviously tongue-in-cheek, obviously a joke, but yeah, that's the sort of prickly little comment that I'm not sure, you know, somebody who's a team manager should really be putting in the public domain.
Maybe that will happen, Lionel. Ye of little faith. You know, Mark Cavendish could turn himself into... completely different kind of rider. Who knows? Listen, we better wrap up. I think you've got to dash off, Ned. You're much in demand by the media today. So we're very.
Here's one thing. Have a little look at the 6-day event coming up in London. You're talking about forthcoming races. I think this is going to be on Eurosport as well, by the way. So there you go. Hashtag home with cycling.
That's going to be turned into a jingle.
No, it's not. Yeah, it is. What the hell? Anyway, have a look at the 6-day event coming up in London that Mark Cavendish was supposed to be riding, but isn't. But I am working on the event, and I've just come from the velodrome, actually. And I've had a sneaky little preview look at the riders who are going to be riding. And in terms of 6-dayness and trackiness and all that kind of thing, it's proper good and very international. And... yeah, a 6-day for the first time in 30 or 35 years. I think the last one was at Wembley Arena, a Skoll 6-day. It's back, and I think we should all get behind it because it could become a thing.
We're going to do a little featurette on the 6-day, looking ahead to that. We're going to speak to Gary Beckett, who's got lots of experience of working on 6-day races as a soigneur, and Rob Hales and the people out, I think.
Yeah, and if you want to listen back to a bit of 6-day action, last year I went to the Ghent 6. You can listen.
How could we forget?
How could you forget? Do you remember the Ghent 6 cat that ran out onto the track and nearly caused a crash? There was an international incident about that for 15 or 20 minutes. But yeah, listen back. It was in November 2014. If you go to our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, and go to latest episodes, you'll have to scroll through a bit, but you'll find it, or it's on your iTunes device or whatever. Just scroll back and find it.
Great. Well, listen, thank you very much, Ned, for joining us. Hopefully you'll join us again soon. Thank you, Ned.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Ned.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.